Campus in a Colin Fitzdenowa Minainain Baranin. This is Malta through international eyes on Campus 103.7. My name is Colin Fitz, a program that is followed by many people around the world, people who have a connection with Malta, foreign people who have come to live here, foreign people who visit Malta, have visited many times. Maltese people who have a big connection with an international community or a foreign country. In today's edition, we will be visiting the cutting room floor. Bits and pieces from various interviews that have been broadcast already in previous series or in this current series of Malta Through International Eyes, Minainain Baranin, that's the name of the program that you can find on our website. Sometimes interviews go beyond the 1 hour allocated by this radio station for the program. What I do is I keep some of those extra bits and use them all in a program that is broadcast later on. And this is the case today, where we shall be starting off by hearing Norman Briffa, who was last week's guest. Norman Briffa is a heart surgeon based in the UK. He's been living there since 1978, when he left Malta at the age of 18. This is an interesting story he told me during his interview, but that I couldn't include in last week's program. Something interesting happened to you once in Sheffield that has a connection to Malta.
Yeah, so in 2012, I was asked to give a talk on the history of surgery and history of cardiac surgery, heart surgery, at a patrons group of a theatre company. And after I gave the talk and I explained that I originally was from Malta, a woman came up to me and said, my great uncle had heart surgery in Malta during the First World War. And I kind of didn't want to really believe her. It's not that I disbelieved her, but from my knowledge of the history of cardiac surgery, all the history books relating to the subject state that cardiac surgery didn't really start in any meaningful way until the late 1920s. So, and she mentioned that her great uncle had been operated on in a hospital called St. Elmo Hospital in Valletta. And I spoke to my father, who was a doctor in Malta, and he said he'd never heard of it. But I was intrigued. So in actual fact, what I did is I wrote to the Ministry of Defence and asked whether they had any medical records for this gentleman who was this woman's great uncle. Now, most of the medical records for the First World War had been destroyed, but they showed me they mentioned a reference in a textbook which I could read up about. And sure enough, everything she had said was correct. And this great uncle had been shot in Salonika. He was a horseman in the Derbyshire Yeomanry.
Part of the Battle of the Dardanelles and
Dardanelles
Gallipoli.
And Salonika, exactly.
Yes.
So, as you know, Malta during the First World War was known as Nurse of the Mediterranean. Indeed. And I think there were more than 29 hospitals scattered throughout the island. There wasn't any direct fighting in Malta or close to Malta. And This guy had been injured in Salonika and had been evacuated to Malta. And I think they'd observed him for a while, and then he'd become quite ill. And it was clear from their investigations that the bullet was still lodged in his heart. So he underwent heart surgery at one of these multiple hospitals, which was actually, before the First World War, was a secondary school. Huh? And I've seen pictures of this place, and you could see the granary. So it's right at the very tip of Malta, in front of Fort St. Telmo.
Yes.
That's where the hospital was.
Possibly where we used to do our exams.
Yes. I remember.
O-levels, in the 80s. There were some halls that were used by the education department.
I think that's the one, yeah, because mm-hmm. as I said, in the photo, you could see, on the other side, you could see the
those granaries.
Granaries in front of St. Elmo.
Yes.
And he had the surgery, and the surgery was actually a success, but sadly, he died of wound infection because there were no antibiotics during the First World War.
They came to be in the 40s, didn't
they? Yeah, in the 40s, yes. Yeah. And,
what a story. Oh,
and the other thing I found out that this guy who had his surgery, he used to live before he went off to fight in the First World War. His family house was about half a mile from where I live now in Sheffield.
My goodness, what a coincidence! Yes,
and the other interesting thing I found out was, I don't know if you've heard this, the white feather during the First World War. So when the First World War started, and you can actually see an example of this in one of the earlier episodes of Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
So in when the First World War started in the United Kingdom, there was no conscription. So you volunteered.
Yes.
And if you were a grown man and you didn't volunteer, and women would come up to you and give you a white feather, saying, you publicly stating, you are a coward.
Oh, yeah, you're not going to do your duty.
Your duty for king and country.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, he looked much older than his age. He was 17, but he looked apparently in his 20s.
Yes.
And this woman went up to him in the post office and gave him, and this shocked him so much, he decided to lie about his age.
Oh,
and that happened a lot, apparently. A lot of people, young men who wanted to go and fight for the king and country.
So this is the man that eventually ended up being operated on.
Operated on in Malta. And he died in Malta, and he's buried in Malta, in Pietà, the Commonwealth Cemetery in Pietà.
Goodness me. Which is close to where I used to live as a child.
Yes.
They still have the Anzac commemorations there every year.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. So, and eventually I found out about it, and I think there's, if you could look it up on the Times of Malta website, there's an article about it and a photo of me when I went to visit the graves.
I will certainly look it up on the internet, absolutely, this article.
It is an extraordinary story. The other extraordinary story related to this was, the main surgeon was a guy called Charles Balance, who was an ENT surgeon in London, who was colonel. But the person who helped him, who was also a surgeon, was a woman. And she's probably the first kind of recorded female heart surgeon ever in medical history.
Wow. And she was working here in Malta.
And she was working. And loads of women soldiers came to Malta. And that's another very interesting story, because they were either not paid or paid much less than their male counterparts.
Mm, they would have been in those days.
But even at the time. So Winston Churchill in the 1920s actually brought it up in Parliament about how women doctors were badly treated by the British Army.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah, and many, as I said, many came to Malta. And she was from Southampton. And I actually got to know her great-great-grandniece who lives in Glasgow. It's a complicated story, but I eventually, somebody told her that I had an interest, because I had published a couple of papers about this.
Mm-hmm.
And she sent me loads and loads of photos of her time in Malta.
Gosh.
And I've got photos, you know, it says Fortress Malta underneath.
Oh, wow.
Which was like an official title.
And they're in your collection.
Yeah.
Maybe one day you can also at least provide copies to the archives, the National Archives. Or
I should do, yeah. Actually, pass them on. That's a very good idea.
That would be. They would welcome them with open arms, yeah. Absolutely.
And she
Yeah, I'd like to see them.
So she was from Southampton. She couldn't study medicine in England, so she actually qualified in the University of Chicago. And I actually wrote to the University of Chicago, University of Illinois. University of Illinois, Chicago, was the state universities are named after the states rather than the cities. And they sent me her graduation photo. Her name was Sarah Marguerite White, and she was the second, the main surgical assistant on this chap's heart operation. That was the first that occurred in Malta in 1917.
Well, the thing is, as you mentioned in our interview in one of the episodes of the series Benign in Barani in Malta Through International Eyes, when it comes to medicine in Malta and the Maltese community, we punch above our weight. We've exported a lot of medical professionals, doctors and specialists spread around the world, many of them in the UK, but also in America and many other places. And it must be, number one, it must be the history of medicine, the tradition of being a medical practitioner in Malta probably became ingrained in our culture and attractive to many people. With the influence of the Knights of St. John for so many years here in Malta between 1530 and 1798, but also the First World War when Malta was the nurse of the Mediterranean, and all these international medical specialists being based here must have influenced the Maltese to follow the same path. And this particular lady, for example, should be considered a hero of Malta, I think.
No, absolutely.
Over the years, absolutely. Right? Rather than, I mean, it's great to have heroes in war or in sport or in this or that, but why not from the medical profession as well?
Absolutely. Actually, you saying that, maybe I should write...
Publish
something about this woman in the Maltese press, yeah.
I very much encourage you not only to do that, but also to write your memoirs and your story. I think many of our listeners found interesting when it was broadcast as part of this series. But you have so many stories to tell, and so many of these asides as well, and little discoveries you've made.
Yeah.
Was Norman Briffa, a heart surgeon based in Sheffield in the United Kingdom. He's been there since 1978. He spent the first 18 years of his life in Malta. However, he visits Malta regularly nowadays. Next up, the half-French, half-British filmmaker who has been living in Malta for the last 10 years. This is a part of the interview that could not be used in his episode. Is Malta somewhere that you see yourself being based for a long time, or for maybe even the rest of your life?
Yeah, again, I don't have. I've changed my lifestyle.
You don't necessarily have to have a relationship to do that.
But my lifestyle has changed a lot since I live in Malta, and this is another thing that I'm thankful to Malta for, is that it made me realize what kind of life balance I needed, what kind of lifestyle I needed. I'm lucky enough that I work in the industry that I always wanted to work in. That work and that industry helps to give me that balance as well. And it kind of made me delete a little bit this aspect of goals and future and going a little bit more with the moment and with the flow. It's the case for the work because you never know which next project is coming, what it is going to be, and all this. It's a bit like that. And I've embraced that. And I've embraced, I think it's also to do with mental health, is to be able to embrace things you don't have control on and to let things come and see where it takes you. But
if your job, if a movie comes along and says, Maxime Durand, we need you to come to this country to work, and then... you end up working in that country for a few months and then you stay there. Will Malta always feature, remain in your heart, in your life?
For sure. No, Malta will be like probably the biggest chapter of my life, if I'm honest. Because there's so many things. There's so many things that were dear to me that happened here, but it's also how it shaped me and just how it made me, realize a lot of things and understand myself, in fact. It helped me understand myself more. So that's quite something.
Because do you think you'll ever, as a filmmaker, do you think you'll ever make a big epic movie that has Malta at its heart? Maybe in 10, 20, 30 years' time when you're big and powerful and rich.
I really wish this never happens to me. I would hate that very much. No. I think Malta I think it has enough of its own self. It doesn't need it. I feel like it would be almost... I'd feel like I'm condescending Malta by trying to portray it in a way or another. Malta is dear to me, but in a personal way. Mm. Maybe some people can relate to certain stuff, but on a general level, it's like a love relationship. It's only the people involved can really understand it. So my love relationship with Malta only me can really get it. You know what I mean? Okay. I don't think I can really portray it. And I will do a clumsy job of it. It wouldn't be representative.
Even quite active on social media, like putting up posts about various situations or various issues that you feel passionate about. You feel you're one of us now, and that you have the right to speak about things because you understand them rather than maybe in the first couple of years when you were still finding your feet. Am I making sense? Am I
totally
correct?
No, you have it. You completely nailed it.
There's a little part of you almost feel Maltese now.
I don't really have an identity kind of like search.
Okay.
So I've never felt totally French. I've never felt totally English. Maybe the fact that I was always the Brit in France and I was always the Frenchman in England helped that.
Yes.
Because it kind of dissociated with my roots. And I realized that, I don't know, for me, not really actually important.
So you're just, in Malta, you're just Maxime.
I am, but I feel very connected to this place, more connected than I've ever felt in France and England.
Oh, that's nice.
That's why I've never really cared about the faith that much of those countries, and I do about Malta.
So
I feel
what
like
are the
art.
Things? Yeah, what are the things that you've been posting about, for example, on social media to try and raise awareness about things that you feel could be better?
I mean, it was strongly influenced at first by environment. That's something that has been with me for a long time. My first short film related to the environment was in 2006. So I have been on the subject for quite a while. So when I saw how, at least when I moved in, because I saw a difference. So when I arrived in 2014, I saw an evolution and that I didn't like. And I was realizing there's something awfully wrong with the way things are being handled here when it comes to that.
Okay.
So even the series that I did coming soon was really quite related to that as well, was like the bad management of transport, of going to from point A to point B in Malta, which is a small country, shouldn't be that hard or that much of a problem or that much of a headache for everything and everybody. So that was the motivation behind it. It was satire, but it was really to raise awareness as well, because when I dived into it, I realized it's not a problem happening because of mismanagement or incompetence. It's happening by design. Oh. And when I started realizing it's happening...
Is that what you feel? Is that what you...
No, is that what I discovered? I really searched the subject a lot.
You're very passionate about these things that you say you discovered and that you feel. Do you see yourself becoming more of an activist as time goes by? Or
no,
is it just posting your opinion
Is
on
this, yeah.
Media?
I don't have any... There's no goal or anything. I just.
Do you find yourself getting into arguments though with people who disagree with you?
Sometimes.
Who say that no, that's not what's happening.
Sometimes, but more often than not, I see people that discover that I know what I'm talking about. Sometimes they're surprised that as a foreigner, I know the names of the politicians, the corporate people. I know what they do. I know their past. I've looked into it quite extensively. So more often than not, I discover people. That know less than me, and I don't like saying this out loud, and especially not on the radio show. But it is the reality. I'm being told quite a lot. It's like, oh, I didn't know this or that person or those relationships between people, and things like this. I feel it at heart. This is the thing that I've almost never been told go back to your country.
No,
in 10 years, yeah. I've never been, because I think. A lot of the people, even the people that would tend to say those words, would hit a wall with me because they would see I'm not someone who is mingling or interfering for any other purpose than just the love of this place. That my care and my knowledge about it also comes from that. It comes solely because of care. I'm not like breaking my brain trying to really learn by heart all this. No, it really is natural. A natural process of like caring about the place. I want to defend it. And despite its history of being invaded and being colonized and all this, its biggest enemy today are locals. They are local people.
Making bad decisions
or self-interested decisions, self-serving.
Okay, well, that's a very passionate declaration from your part, and it's commendable. So you're going to try and find a way to learn some more.
I want to, and the problem is I keep repeating things. I keep repeating things I've learned. So, for example, there's like words. I don't know. I'm trying to find an example. Kolosh. It took me years to remember what it means. And the thing is that how many times do you need to learn something again and again and again? And I just keep forgetting the meaning of words.
So you were working with a director who's one of your heroes.
I mean, I wouldn't say a hero, but he was clearly a reference of films that made that forged my love for cinema, no doubt.
How important, from that experience right up to, you've been 10 years now, how important is it to remain very professional and resist asking these people who might be important to you or were important to you, maybe when you were a child or are famous, to resist asking for a selfie with them, unless it's absolutely when they're relaxed and it's appropriate to do so.
Yeah, I'm a total wuss. I don't even go near that.
You don't even do that at all?
No, I'm too intimidated. I'm too intimidated, and also I don't have a smartphone, so I don't really do selfies.
Gosh, but, why is that? How interesting.
But then I'm just too intimidated. I'm too shy. In reality, and also.
Well, it works out well because it's not really the thing to do, especially when they're working.
No,
that's the last thing they want.
And then eventually, when I became more professional, because I used to, and then I eventually worked in it full time. Then I realized yes, it's actually a thing that we tell people, we tell extras not to do. Sometimes it's very, very big actors, and we say absolutely don't go near that thought. Of even asking or even addressing them sometimes, because you're just going to get fired instantly.
And it's not because the actor, although sometimes they are, but it's not because the actor, male or female, is a diva. Mm-hmm. It just, that's the way it is.
It's the way it is. It's a protection.
You don't go around.
It's a protection. These people are famous. They don't have our life. They can't be around and walking the streets in the supermarket as regular people. They have only a very few safe places in the world, which is their own home. and work. Mm. So so the workplace is supposed to be as protected as...
And also, if they're on set and they're about to do a part, mm-hmm. they're concentrating, they're focusing, and if some little idiot goes mm-hmm. up and says, I'm going to have a selfie, you're disturbing their train of thought.
Yeah.
And whatever.
You could. So you I mean, everybody has that, different methods. Every actor has different yeah. methods and all this, yeah. but it can be that. So yes. if you're being... I mean, how you can miss a scene or badly play a scene. Imagine what it is to have, you know, screwed that up just because of an extra.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an extra or a grip or a spark. Or it yeah. can be anybody, really. But, you know, I mean, it's a protection that is... Just it has to be there. It's part of the foundation, so just to protect them.
Those were various comments from my guest Maxime Durand, half French, half British, has been in Malta for the last 10 years, involved in the film industry. Comments which I could not use because of time constraints in the episode where I interviewed him. This episode can be found in our archives on the Campus 103.7 website. And now let's hear from Kate Degtyareva from Belarus. We heard from her a few weeks ago. Kate and her family moved to Malta from Belarus a few years ago, and these are some comments which were not included in the episode that featured her interview. Have you ever encountered people here in Malta? Actually, are there other Belarusians here?
Belarusians.
Belarusians. I'll say it properly. Are there other Belarusians here in Malta that you know?
Yes, there are a lot of people from Belarus. And to be honest, I was surprised when we came here to Malta to understand that Russian-speaking community, like from Belarus, Russia, Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, most people speak Russian as well. Mm-hmm. So it's such a big community here. And
yes.
Every person here is with his history, and it's very interesting to get to know each other.
Yes,
I'm
of course.
Absolutely surprised, and I'm very grateful that I'm in a such multicultural country,
mm-hmm.
because it really helps to go through all these relocation problems.
Mm-hmm. You can always ask people, friends.
Yes, they are friends.
With advice,
yes.
Yes. And you're happy with the level of education that your children are receiving?
Yes, right now, on this level, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it will be in the secondary school. I don't want to think about it right now.
Step by step.
Yes, step by step, exactly. But right now, I really like every teacher at school,
mm-hmm.
Because my eldest daughter, she... The first studied at Nashar Induction Hub.
Okay.
So this is the hub where children learn intensively English and Maltese to start the mainstream in primary school, for example.
I see.
So she started to learn there.
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers are amazing. She loves Maltese even more than me. She loves Maltese more than English.
Yes.
I was really surprised by this fact,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
she found it for her, it is easier to speak Maltese than English. To reduce traffic. But I don't. But I don't know how to make it.
Yeah, that's a big ask. That's a big question.
Yes, yes. I fully understand that it's almost impossible. Yes. But of course, but for people who live here, for tourists maybe it's okay. But for people who live here, indeed, it's very difficult.
You're doing your part because you live in a village and you stay at home or you do your work from home, as does your husband most of the time. And your children go to the school in the village.
In the village, yes.
So you don't really do that much driving.
Yes, yes.
Over a period of a week. And if we could get to that stage, maybe more people working from home and that sort of thing, that would help, I guess. But so those are your main points and negatives.
I believe, yes, these are the main points. But most, maybe marketplaces. Maybe to marketplaces.
More marketplaces. You'd like to see more?
Yeah, but I don't know in Malta any marketplaces.
You mean like where you can sort of haggle for a price?
Online shopping that can be, for example, you click right here, right now. You are sitting, you click, and in a day, it will be at your place, for example. Mm-hmm, so the customer service is here as well. So the delivery is can be for three or from 3 days, even though it is in Malta situated, but the delivery will be in 3 days. But 3 days, it's
a long time.
It's quite good.
Oh, it's quite good.
It's
okay,
quite good. Sometimes, yes, sometimes it can be longer. Yes.
Okay.
Like marketplaces. I mean, for example, in Russia, it's mostly in Russia, but in Belarus as well, we have such marketplace like Wildberries, where you can shop online and you can find everything from clothes to any appliances at home. But and you can, they have different locations in your area, even in your, we have no villages, we have streets, mainly streets. So you have a town with more than 100 streets.
Yes.
So it is divided in, not in the villages, but streets. And in every street, you can find 2-3 places where they can give it to you, your
like the warehouse. Or
yes.
Like you can go and collect.
Collect, yes. So maybe I'm waiting for such level of marketplace to
marketplace.
Yes, to make life easier. I believe that people, even local people in Malta, they will understand how it's great to have such service.
Interesting.
Because right now, I believe most people don't understand even how it works, but I have an experience in Belarus. That's why I'm talking about this, that it's very, very comfortable and useful. And even it will reduce the traffic.
Of course, of course.
Because you will make everything online, shopping online.
Indeed.
And you can go in your village and collect it on your own. You don't need the delivery even.
From Belarus, that was Kate Degtyareva. And now Dave Samut, who is Maltese but has lived a substantial part of his life in other countries, including the UK and Holland. And here are some parts of his interview which could not be used because of time constraints in his episode from Series 2 of Minainen Baranin, Malta Through International Eyes. Out you had a good voice for radio, and then I think Terry Farrugia,
yeah,
who, as we said, was Maltese Canadian, but had spent the first 20 20 years of his life in Canada. And then moved to Malta and very quickly moved ahead in radio because he had such a great voice and he brought over that American radio style.
Yeah, and he was incredibly passionate and he was a student of radio broadcasting.
Yes, but also of American talk show hosts.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So he had the very quick humor, the very quick wit, and that really impressed a lot of the people who owned radio stations here. Mm. So he very quickly was offered various jobs and then he was asked to lead certain radio stations, and he ended up training a large number of presenters, Maltese and in Maltese and English, even though he was still learning Maltese himself pretty much. But the basics of radio remained the same in any language.
Absolutely.
So, but you were one of sort of Terry's big discoveries, one could say.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
How did your mum find it here in Malta, having, you know, been Ukrainian/Scottish? Then Canadian.
She's the perpetual Baranilla.
Really?
Yeah.
Did she learn Maltese?
No, she didn't. I think she understands. She doesn't tell. She understands. Okay. And she chooses some interesting words to use in Maltese.
But she's integrated. But well,
she has her own little lifestyle and thing. Yeah, absolutely.
I should interview her as
well. Yeah, sure. I'm sure she'd be more than happy to
do it. Absolutely. Do you remember whether your mum's family got on with your dad's family, the Maltese and the Scottish/Ukrainian?
I think there was, like with anything, right, there's a degree of novelty in something that's different and appreciated. But once you're family, you're familiar, right? And so, but I think that at the end of the day, I think there's so many similarities, especially living in Canada, that it was... It was just trying to get by. Yeah, it's fine. It was fairly normal, and so much that, you know, like my dad would sample the delights of Eastern European, and likewise my mom's family would taste you know, these
Mediterranean
stuff, and like eating rabbit and that kind of.
When you were in Canada, did you attend a sort of multicultural school?
Yeah, I attended a public school in Canada. It wasn't a Catholic school. This is interesting because there was a Maltese or a Roman Catholic school, but I didn't go there. I went to a public school. Okay. So it was...
And there were like children of various...
Oh, it was completely multicultural, multicultural. But my cousins who live not too far away from us, they went to the school. It's called James Collin. And a lot of Canadians who... returned to Malta, their kids went to that school because of it. But we went to this different school, which is fine. I got to see different cultures. The always positive and bubbly Dave Samut, a former radio broadcaster here in Malta, but who has spent substantial amounts of time living and working in places like the UK and Holland. He also spent the first few years of his life in Canada. To conclude today's edition of Minainein Baranin, Malta Through International Eyes, Malta being mentioned in international media by famous people. Let's take a listen to an interview with Derek Fowles, an English actor who passed away a few years ago, but who was famous for playing the part of Bernard in the series Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, two 80s series, a comedy programme made by the BBC. He was also an actor on the long-standing British series Heartbeat. But Derek Fowles has a small connection with Malta.
I was born in London, in Clapham Common, and we had a house in Stormont Road, and but of course then the war broke out, the Blitz, and my mother thought it was a good idea for me to go down to stay with my grandmother. So my sister Babs and I were shipped off to Berkhamsted, and then sadly my father died while we were down there, and we never moved back to London. I was brought up by a darling mum and a sister and maiden aunts. I was surrounded by women. My grandmother became my mother, and my mother became really my dad, because she had to go out and, you know, and earn the pennies. You know, I failed my 11 plus, so I never really had an education, so you used to go, in those days, you went to a secondary modern school and you left at 15 and you become apprentices. We were all carpenters or electricians or plumbers, or and I was an apprentice printer. But while I was at school, I was cast in an operetta called Dogs of Devon, and it was the first time I'd acted on a stage, and I thought, God, this is rather fun. Enid, who was my English teacher, she cast me in A Midsummer Night's Dream as Bottom. And I got lots of laughs, and I love that feeling of getting laughs. And I thought, this is fun. And I thought acting was like a hobby. I never said I want to be an actor. I never thought about being an actor. It was all because of Enid, really, because she was the one at school. You know, the corn is green, you always have that teacher that, you know, really makes an impression and takes you on board and encourages you. So she was a mentor and said to me, Derek, you know, don't give up your acting, because I think you have a talent. But I had a talent for playing cricket and football, and I joined. I was a cub, I was a scout, I had the most wonderful childhood in Burko. I went away to do my national service in Malta. Out there I met a sergeant in the army called Donald Douglas, and he and I joined the same drama group in Malta. And Donald said to me, I want to be an actor. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm going to try for RADA. And he said, well, why don't you have a go? And I said, I don't think my mother will allow me to become an actor. Anyway, he wrote to RADA for me, and through the post came all these speeches that I had to learn, and I stood on the stage and I couldn't see anybody. It was all very dark, and they said, hello, and I said, hello, who are you, where are you, and what are you going to do for us? I said, oh, well, I'm going to do a bit from the Seagull, and then I did Gunga Din, can you believe? And then they said, we'll let you know. And I said, look, you have to tell me because I'm supposed to go back to work at the factory on Monday morning, and you have to give me a scholarship and a grant, otherwise I can't come here. Anyway, they came to me and said, will you come back on Thursday and do two more pieces? And I did a bit from Bottom that I played at school, and I did a bit from School for Scandal, and I went back and I said, hello, it's me, I'm back. And they said, what have you got for us? I said, I'm going to do this. And they said, thank you very much, we'll let you know. And I had to wait 10 days. And then I was in bed. And my mother, we had a bell. I've still got the bell upstairs. She rang the bell and she said, there's a letter from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
Derek Fowlds, the late British actor, famous for his part in the series Yes, Minister. And now, one of the world's most recognizable podcasters, Joe Rogan, the biggest podcaster in the United States, but also listened to and watched around the world via his channel on YouTube and on other platforms. I happened to be watching one of Joe Rogan's podcasts when Malta's name came up.
Thing is, it's like a skyscraper on its side.
Yeah.
And it's one solid piece.
And it was moved there.
Yes.
See, pull up the Baalbek stones in Lebanon, because there's stuff that's above it that is like of a more recent time period, but it seems to have been put there on top of these older stones that are so big they don't make any sense. Like, that's just one of them that was quarried but not moved. But
right.
The ones that are in place, go to the ones that, like, see, you don't realize how big they are unless you can get a human being to stand next to them. But
right.
They are preposterously big. Like, there you go.
Right.
Like, you...
15 feet high, 30, 40 feet long. I mean, they're showing in metric, so I'm confused.
Incredible.
Right.
And like, who? Who did it? And when? When was that done? And then there's like Malta, like that stuff that they think Malta was constructed when the sea levels were much lower. So there was a way to make a path to there. from Italy and from these other places,
sure,
because they found Neanderthal bones there. And
that, so, allegedly, yeah, giants built that. And Derinkuyu and all the hidden cities, mm-hmm, underneath Cappadocia and Turkey that they're finding are connected.
Those are nuts.
No one knows who made them.
That was an excerpt from an episode of Joe Rogan's podcast. This has been Malta Through International Eyes, Minaynayn Baranin, from the cutting room floor. Clips from previous shows that could not be used because of time constraints, and a couple of clips from the international media that have mentioned a relationship with Malta. Minaynayn Baranin returns today week at the same time. I'm Colin Fitz. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, this series is uploaded to the Campus 103.7 website.